This is a very serious podcast.
Oh, bottle of mine that you have always wanted. Bottle of mine, why was I ever decanted? Skies are blue inside of you. The weather's always fine for. There ain't no bottle in all the world like that dear little bottle of mine.
That actually sounded really nice.
This is what passes for entertainment and poetry in the world of Brave New World.
Mm-hmm.
Singing about the bottle in which they were gestated.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, did they have the same bottle the whole time? Or did they, like,
full 9 months?
Decant them into different bottles?
No, I think they said they were in the same bottle the whole time.
I was just wondering if they maybe, like, put them in a different bottle, like a kombucha or something.
Like, when they get bigger?
We had a whole song about kombucha.
Yeah,
that
it was
teen spirit.
It was, how did it go?
It's a SCOBY in a bottle, the kombucha, really nasty, something
it's
like that.
It's eternal, lasts like, forever, it goes on and on and on and on. It's kombucha, lasts forever, it's a fungus.
It's among us, pass it on to... To your children, your grandchildren, great-grandchildren.
It goes on and on and on and on.
Oh, my gosh. All right. Well, I think we've goofed off enough for the intro.
Was that our intro?
Welcome to Spanknicks, the Society for the Preservation of Literature, the Arts, Numinosity, culture, humor, nerdiness, inspiration, creativity, and storytelling.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this next episode of Spanknicks. I'm your host, Claire T. Walker. I'm an independent author, and I'm joined by my co-host, as always, my daughter, Hannah Kubiak.
Hello.
Today, Hannah and I are going to be talking about Aldous Huxley's 1932 hilarious and terrifying dystopic novel, Brave New World.
That was really good. I try not to look at you while you're doing the intros because we always start cracking up.
Because I'll start laughing.
Yeah.
I did it.
Yeah, you did
it.
One
take.
Good job.
Yeah, baby.
Yeah, it's harder.
She nailed it.
It's harder than it seems.
Hannah, do you want to give us some background about this amazing novel?
Oh, yes. It was published in 1932 by Aldous Huxley. Aldous?
I just say Aldous.
Aldous?
Yeah.
Are you sure it's not Aldous?
Aldous?
Aldous. Aldous! There he is! Aldous in the house!
Aldous in the house!
Hoo, hoo, hoo! Anyway.
Continue.
Yes, he died on November 3rd, and it's the same day... Oh, in 1963, sorry. It's the same day as JFK and C.S. Lewis.
Same exact year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Uh-huh. He had an upper-class British education, Eton and Oxford. Maybe it was Aldous Huxley you were talking about before he went to a boarding school,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, he went to
Did
a boarding school.
Did you mention
school? It? Yeah.
You was, mentioned C.S. Lewis, and then you said there was somebody else I was reading about recently who went to a boarding school.
Yeah, but I didn't read about any of the actual experiences that he had. The author I was reading about before, I know C.S. Lewis had terrible experiences at his...
Didn't somebody toss him in a coal chute? Like, it was some sort of, like, lower-classman hazing thing?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't remember if it was Aldous Huxley who I was reading about, but yeah.
Mm. Okay.
Those British boarding schools, nasty places.
Yeah.
Nasty, brutish, and short.
So Brave New World is about a future Earth in which human beings are mass-produced by artificial reproduction and gestation, created in a bottle, basically. They are conditioned from fertilization through adolescence to accept a certain place in society and a certain way of thinking and behaving. And this is how social stability is maintained. They keep people very well-fed. They keep them entertained and very complacent with the help of... basically, they're just taught to drug themselves to feel better. Psychoactive drugs. I think that the thing that disturbed me the most about this world is actually the class system, where it's like, okay, these are going to be alphas, these are going to be betas, and then there's like the gammas and the epsilons, where they say we like purposely we purposely put alcohol into their bottle while they're gestating so that they grow up stunted and unintelligent, only capable of doing like menial tasks. And like, I just think that's horrible. Before they're even, well, technically born, you're saying, okay, this person is going to mop floors. He's not going to know how to do anything else. And he's going to be happy while doing it.
One of the lines in the later part of the book is, they make people unable to want anything they can't have.
Mm.
And they make them want what they've got. And not only that, but love what they've got and what they're doing and where they are.
Yeah, they're conditioned. They have various things that they do to condition the children to like some things and dislike other things, to like their place in the world. They like have these sort of like tapes playing during their nap time when they're really little.
It is in many ways less brutal than a 1984 type dystopia, and certainly less brutal than some real life dystopias that we have lived through, like the Nazi regime and communist regimes and things like that. And it is, in fact, in many ways, quite a humane dystopia, but it is a dystopia nonetheless, because it completely dehumanizes everyone in it.
Yeah.
Except for the people at the very top.
Mm-hmm.
That's how dystopias are constructed in narrative form, fictionally. Mm-hmm. You've got the elite sort of inner circle at the top. You've got all the masses at the bottom, in the middle and the bottom. And then you always have, when you tell the story, you place some sort of rebellious element into it. It's a satire. And because of that, it's really, there are parts of this that are hilarious. I mean, you listen to that song.
Mm.
That's a song that they sing at the dance hall as they're dancing around. Literally are singing the song about the bottle that they were gestated in. So what is satire? It's a type of literature in which the author targets prevalent evils in the world that he or she observes, or possible future evils.
Yeah.
And also targets observable human traits and types.
Mm.
So a satirist calls attention to a problem that he or she sees in the world in the hopes that something can be done to solve that problem or put a stop to the situation. And what satirists use is humor and irony to open people's eyes to that problem in the world. So the purpose of it is to illustrate the absurd by being absurd. I mean, these people dancing around singing about their bottles, you know, and then and the people will say things that are deeply ironic and disturbing to a modern reader. And yet these people are dead serious about this. They're thinking this is great. So you'll illustrate the absurd by being absurd. You depict a disturbing possibility or even a current problem. And you try to almost ridicule it so effectively that it might go out of existence. You hope that the satire, the writer of the satire, hopes that what he or she is writing is a self-negating prophecy. So you just mentioned one of the current problems that Huxley extrapolates from, the idea of class distinctions and castes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Huxley came from very much a society like that. He's English.
Mm.
England is very much class distinctive, and there is no mobility among those classes. You're born into what you're born into, and there's where you are. What are some of the other elements of that society that, or I should say, elements of our current society, like in real life, that Huxley may have observed that he targeted?
Scientific advancement, and people are over-reliant on technology. I think it's not necessarily like mechanical, like computers or phones or apps or something. I think it's like all the drugs that is sort of their reliance on technology, because the women who haven't been created to be just sterile, you know, they have to take this drug. Every time you go and have sex with somebody, you got to do this, what they call the Methuselan.
The Malthusian.
Malthusian drill, where you have to like take all these drugs. And there's even like, it's made into sort of like a fashion thing, where you've got all of your Malthusian, like all of your substances, And they're all on, like, this special belt. And it's like a swatch, like swatches.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, I love your belt.
It's a fashion item. I love your Malthusian belt. It's so charming.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And this is, like, the belt with all of the contraceptives on it that they use.
Yeah. So, yeah, just tons of drugs. And not to help them with anything, but to maintain the society the way they want it to be. They don't want anybody to have their own children, which is why they got these, like, contraception drills and stuff they have to do. They're told to take Soma, which is basically like this happy pill kind of thing. And they're told to take that anytime they feel uncomfortable or unhappy, instead of dealing with their emotions, to just make it go away. And people become, like, addicted to it. Another element that we see is there's a lot of industrialization and how inhumane that is. So there's sort of they are more focused on the society as a whole as opposed to individuals. So if you sacrifice certain people so that others can enjoy more comfort and more prosperity, then they do that. Like, the individual is not important. It is the we. It is the collective. The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few.
And in the Brave New World, what they say is, when the individual feels, the community reels.
Yeah, yeah.
They've got all these little rhymes about, you know, everyone belongs to everyone else.
Yeah, so it's weird, because the next one is hedonism, sexual libertinism, and overindulgence in entertainments and things. It sort of leads to them being like stagnation and being almost like zombies. I think of it as them being like... They're like happy pigs.
Happy pigs.
They're like happy pigs, or like almost, they're almost infantilized a little bit.
Oh, they're
almost treated like they're children.
They're deliberately infantilized.
Yeah.
In fact, in the book, it says that is your responsibility to maintain a healthy infantile attitude. Remember, Bernard is remonstrated with by
because
he's not being infantile enough.
Yeah,
they literally, you know, it's like. Do you remember the conversation between Lenina and her friend Fanny?
Mm-hmm.
Where Fanny is criticizing Lenina for not being promiscuous enough.
Right, yeah, where it's like, you mean to say that you're going out with the same man again?
For 4 months? What? You have to be more promiscuous. So, I don't know.
That would lead to something that is being exclusive, right?
Yeah, you can't be exclusive.
You have, it's the community. Everyone belongs to everybody else.
Right. And also, if you go steady with a person for a long enough time, you might run the risk of becoming attached to that person.
Yeah.
So you're remonstrated for not being promiscuous enough. Bernard Marx is remonstrated with for not being infantile enough.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that Huxley was observing, as you know, the reason he came up with this whole idea of this sexual libertinism, is because that's what he observed in the Roaring Twenties.
Oh.
That's what was going on. And this is why the belt is called a Malthusian belt, because there was this sort of resurgence of interest in the thought of, was it Thomas Malthus? Robert Malthus? Malthus? Anyway, he was an advocate of limiting births and doing population control. His society was called the Malthusian Society, and they were proponents of birth control.
Right.
And so Aldous Huxley just took this and made this into a... It's funny. This thing is called a Malthusian belt because it's full of contraceptives. So those are sort of the things that he imagined, or that he saw going on in the culture to target with his satire. And then there were some disturbing possibilities that he may have seen. For example, this idea of you have to sacrifice individual autonomy. You have to give it up, and it's taken away from you, actually, in this particular society, in favor of social stability.
Which I think is really weird, because they are taught to think more about the community, the society at large, and not the individual, and not themselves. But then they're also taught to be extremely hedonistic, you know, and just thinking about their own pleasure all the time.
Yeah.
Which, I guess, it's like, well, as long as the pleasure that they have is that what we give them and have conditioned them to want, then that's totally fine. But if they can, of themselves, be happy without it having something to do with the society. Like, there was something like, people shouldn't ever be alone.
Right.
Something.
Because if people are ever alone, they might run into the danger of thinking.
They might have a thought. Yeah.
They don't want that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, exactly. So they sacrifice your individual autonomy in favor of social stability.
Yep.
The mass production of human beings. Now, something that Huxley observed, okay, mass production of goods
Right.
And this is based directly on the idea of Henry Ford and the assembly line.
Oh, yes. He made the sign of the T, Model T Ford. Okay. Yeah.
Ford becomes like the god. And, mm-hmm. and in the early part of the 20th century, this is Henry Ford invented the assembly line for the mass production of cars.
Mm-hmm.
And so Huxley sort of took that idea and launched it into the future. And you know, it says, there's a line in here where they say, the principle of mass production at last applied to biology, where they're making human beings in a factory.
So consumerism, like disposable society, don't mend things if they break. Right. Get a new one.
It keeps people consuming.
It's like this problem that I have to this day. So I want a pair of good winter boots that I can wear year after year after year. Mm-hmm. Good winter boots are really expensive, more expensive than I can afford at any one time. So I'm going to buy some really like cheap Walmart $15 boots. I'm going to wear them. They're not very good, and they fall apart like that throughout the winter, and I can't use them again after that. So then the next year, I have to go buy another pair of boots from Walmart. And then the next year, I buy another pair of boots from Walmart. So instead of having just this one reliable item, I have these like a repeated crap item over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And I end up spending more on boots doing that than I would buying just the good boots.
And this Brave New World society is built on exactly that way of life.
Like, be a consumer.
You're a good citizen if you are consuming a lot of goods regularly and you're just doing your job that you've been assigned to, entertaining yourself and keeping everything socially stable.
It's like, just shut up and be happy, basically. It's a disposable society, and people, because they're taught not to really have feelings for each other, except so far as, like, they contribute to each other not being lonely and having, like, physical encounters, merely physical. People are viewed kind of as objects, and they're therefore disposable as well. So, like, people aren't allowed to get old. They just are incinerated. When they reach a certain age,
no one's allowed to get old. They don't get sick.
And yet, well, yeah, because if people are old, they can remember what was going on ages ago, and they could tell people how life used to be. But if you get rid of all the people who would remember the distant past, then it's just the present.
And they do that from 0 to 60.
Mm-hmm.
Because they have nothing that ever makes them unhappy or ever makes them wonder about anything, never makes them long for something different or something more.
Mm-hmm.
And they, and this idea, this comes up a lot actually in science fiction, doesn't it? This idea of a youth-centered society in which the old, or even the young, like in Logan's Run, you get to 30 years old and you're done.
I thought it was 21.
21? Was it 21?
Yeah, which I, now that I'm thinking about it, I'm like, that seems ridiculous. Like, my life hadn't even begun, really, when I was 21. I hadn't done anything with my life yet, which is probably the point.
Yeah. Exactly.
Like your teenage years, early 20s is when you do stupid things and because you don't know any better.
Yeah.
You don't.
So the idea is this. And Huxley is so good at this because he's presenting us with these horrible possibilities, but he's employing irony in presenting this satire, and it's funny.
Yeah.
It's hilarious. Like there's this one part in where they're touring the hatchery, and the director of hatcheries is describing all of these things, and he's saying, future rocket plane engineers are conditioned so that they're only truly happy standing on their heads. The humor of it really was highlighted to me in my latest reading. I'm going to jump ahead real quick just to read you this hilarious line.
Okay.
It's the scene where the Savage he's having his big protest, and he's overturning the tables in the hospital to disrupt the soma distribution. There's a riot because he's throwing away all the people's happy drugs.
Yeah.
He's saying, I want you to be free. I want you to be free. And then suddenly the voice comes. Suddenly, from out of the synthetic music box, a voice began to speak. The voice of reason. The voice of good feeling. The soundtrack roll was unwinding itself in synthetic anti-riot speech. Number 2, medium strength. And so strength. My friends. And then later on, they come in, the police come in with these water pistols loaded with soma spray.
Yeah.
And the guy says, will you come silent? Will you come quietly? Asked the sergeant, or must we anesthetize? He pointed his water pistol menacingly. I mean, it was hilarious. I was just laughing when I read that.
Yeah.
So funny the way they quell this riot with soma gas, soma vapor. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the humor of this is just, it's brilliant. And I really appreciated that on my latest reading through. As a dystopia, it's one of the more humane ones, because the way they deal with rebels is quite kind in a way. And we have a couple different rebels in this book. We have Helmholtz Watson. His job in the Brave New World is to write the hypnopedic conditioning scripts and various propaganda mm-hmm. for the society. So he has to write those ridiculous rhymes. But the thing about Helmholtz Watson is that he's actually a true poet. He desires to create true art. He desires individuality and transcendence, but he's got no material with which to express that. How can you write something about nothing? He complains that he's just got nothing to work with. Then there's Bernard Marx. He's one of the main characters of the book for mm-hmm. quite a while until we meet the Savage. Now, Bernard he's an alpha. Mm-hmm. Helmholtz is an alpha and Bernard is an alpha. They're like the top tier. The nature of their work is that they do need to have a little bit of autonomy. But Bernard Marx, he has feelings of inferiority. He rebels by wallowing in his negative feelings, and he refuses to take his soma, and he rejects conformity to that. And what happens is his inferiority complex turns him into a vengeful little schmuck. And then there's Mustafa Mond. Mm. He was a true scientist. He was interested in truth and transcendence. And he rebels by being curious, by wanting to learn, by mm-hmm. actually trying to find the limits of knowledge. These three alphas, some errors and slippages and conditioning occurred. But the Brave New World cannot tolerate any kind of individuality or human drive. So so they have to do something to put these people back in their place somehow to maintain the social stability. So what do they do with the rebels?
So it's a soft totalitarianism in Brave New World. So like in 1984, that's pretty hard totalitarianism. If you even think a rebellious thought, you're just sort of made to disappear, or you're threatened with torture and things like that. So that's what keeps people in line. But a soft totalitarianism deals with rebels in a couple of different ways. One is by giving the rebel what he wants. So, for example, that the poet, Helmholtz Watson, they exiled him to an isolated island where he could write poems, and he went willingly. They make the rebel want what he rebelled against. So this is kind of what happened to Bernard Marx. So he had this sort of vengefulness, and wasn't that kind of why he brought the Savage back, was because he figured out that one of the controllers was actually the Savage's father.
Yes. He had this little scheme that he dreamed up when he saw Linda and the Savage. He realized what had mm-hmm. happened, and his little vengeful wheels were turning, and he thought of this scheme.
Yeah. He said, "Yeah, I'll bring this Savage back, and the Savage will call this controller father, and then that'll be really embarrassing for him, you know."
But then everyone in the society kind of played along, and they're like, even though Bernard wasn't very popular, they're like, okay, well, he's connected to this Savage, so he's gonna get what he wants, which is to be famous and have girls flocking around him. And and then it turned out that even though he was disdainful of all that stuff, like, remember, he was complaining because he was overhearing two men talking about Lenina, and they were talking about her like she was a piece of meat, and he was just offended by that. He's like, oh, and she doesn't mind being a piece of meat. Well, turn the tables, and all of a sudden he's popular and getting all the girls. He's like, oh, this is great.
Another way is by giving the rebel control over what they reject. So this is what happened to Mustafa Mond. So he was made a world controller. Once he had like these sort of transgressive scientific explorations. He was curious about stuff. And when it became known to the leaders that he was doing these sort of experiments, they gave him a choice of either accepting exile or accepting a leadership position. And he had a bit of an ego, so he took the leadership position.
Yeah.
I don't know. Given the same choice, I'm not sure I would have made the choice he did.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know,
it's like only insane people or egotistical maniacs want to be, like, president of the United States, right?
Exactly. I often joke that I wouldn't want to be, you know, mayor of the little town that I live in, let alone president. So yeah, there's a certain mindset that craves control over others and control over systems. And, you know, and this is the type of person Mustafa Mond was.
Yeah.
And so it's so interesting how Huxley sets this up and contrasts these people.
But then what about John the Savage? I guess we should talk about who John the Savage is and where he comes from. Bernard takes Lenina to the reservation, where people are savages. They don't have conditioning. They don't have soma. They don't have contraception. They're allowed to get old and decrepit and senile and ugly.
Men and women get married.
Men and women get married and are exclusive.
Yeah.
There are families. The controller, which controller?
The director of hatcheries.
The director of hatcheries was John the Savage's father. And this happened because the director of hatcheries went to the reservation 20 years ago with his girl he was seeing at the time. And her Malthusian drill did not work for some reason. She got pregnant. And then did he leave her there or did he think that she died?
She got lost. It was a storm. They got separated. And he looked all over for her, and he became injured in the storm looking for her or coming back, and she couldn't find her he couldn't find her anywhere.
Uh-huh.
And then it was time to go, and he just left.
Yeah.
And she was stranded there.
See, I thought that he, like, knew that the drill hadn't worked, and he just left her there because he thought that would be, because that was just embarrassing for him.
He didn't know. He was surprised.
I thought he was just this real jerk who was just like, well, this cannot come out.
Well, I mean, he was a real jerk because he didn't bother to actually try to seriously find her, look for her for more than 12 hours.
Yeah, he's like, oh, well.
You know, yeah.
So just go back to London and get another piece of meat. That's fine.
So then we have a very much a fish out of water. We have this highly conditioned, I think Linda was a beta.
Yeah.
And she's thrown into this life where she's pregnant, a civilized person living among these savages.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, a highly conditioned artificial person living among natural people.
Yeah.
And she didn't do well at all because she was promiscuous, which got her into trouble with the society.
Yeah, with the wives of pretty much all the men in the village.
Yeah.
Right?
She was incapable of doing anything. So she and John dressed like slobs because she did not know how to repair clothing.
And she became an alcoholic as well because that was sort of the closest you could get to soma on the reservation.
So John is a person who grew up in on the reservation, the son of this civilized person, and he was rejected by the society because he's a white guy and the rest of them are all, you know, they're Pueblo Indians. So he was set apart and he's isolated and so was she because of her behavior.
Yeah.
And then Bernard and Lenina come to visit the reservation.
Yeah.
Bernard sees this pair, Linda and John, figures out what happened because he knew about the director of hatcheries losing
his
Linda
girl
in the storm.
Yeah.
And then Bernard brings John and Linda back to civilization with him.
The guy who grew up normally.
Basically normal, yes.
Basically normally. I mean, as normal as you can be when you have a single mother who sleeps around and drinks herself into stupefaction every day.
And he was also rejected by the group, basically.
Yeah. So he doesn't really have any desires that the Brave New World can fulfill. So the Brave New World being London. Because he has mostly negative demands. I guess, like, do you want this? Do you want this? It's like, I don't want any of that. He wanted something he couldn't describe very well.
He couldn't describe his desire for something other than sensual pleasures and creature comforts.
Yeah.
And he couldn't articulate well the fact that he longed for transcendence.
Mm-hmm.
He longed for a kind of companionship that was deep and profound.
Yeah,
not
special.
Yeah, he wanted, like, he fell in love with Lenina, but he was a romantic. He wanted to, like, Lenina was like, wanted to go to bed with him immediately, but he was like, no, I want to prove my love to you. I want to deserve this, and I want to have it be a noble, you know, experience.
Yeah, because he said, in the village, if a man wanted to marry a woman, he had, like, bring her a lion pelt from a lion that he had killed or something. Lenina was just like, you don't have to do any of that. Here I am, you know? Like, didn't she just, like... She just, like, took off all her clothes, and she was like, okay, here we go. And he's like, wait a minute, no, stop it. Like, I haven't even proved myself. You don't know anything about me first and get to know you.
Yeah.
She's like, why?
And they just, they did not compute.
No, it didn't compute. He's like, yes, I want to be with you, but I don't want to, like...
But not like this.
But not like this. Not, like, where... Yeah. Not... Because it's like, because everybody's together with everybody else, like... It's just not, it's not special anymore. He wanted the right to be unhappy as well. People tried to get him to take Soma and to get him to, like Lenina took him to the Feelies, right?
Yeah.
It's not the movies, it's the Feelies.
Yeah, and notice how, this is so interesting, the whole idea of sensual gratification, it covers every sense. In the Feelies, every sense, in fact, the whole world, every sense is gratified because they have visual things to distract you all the time. Mm-hmm. They have music playing all the time. They have this thing called the scent organ. Mm-hmm. And it's this thing that just puffs out things, nice things to smell. Mm-hmm. And they have like a symphony of smell, and they describe it in all this ensemble of smell.
Yeah, then
the feelies, you put your hands on these handles in the seat, and you can feel everything, including the kisses on your own mouth.
Yeah.
And John is like, blah! He didn't like that at all. Uh-huh. It's his base. It's disgusting. And
Yeah. And he wanted less from society, to be able to do things for himself. And they're like, I don't want a gamma to do it for me. I want to do it myself. It's like the idea of actually doing something and accomplishing something instead of just sort of consuming things.
Right.
You know.
Right. But yeah, when you read Mustafa Mann's conversation with John towards the end of the book, he's like, no. The whole purpose of this society is to do everything we can to make it socially stable. We don't want anyone to do anything other than what they're conditioned to do. We don't want them to want to do anything other than what they're conditioned to want to do.
Yeah.
When we want them to spend their time consuming things, entertaining themselves, but interestingly enough, they also understand that a certain amount of work is necessary because too much leisure, the people start to get a little bit restless. So they understand that some sort of purposeful work that you're conditioned to want and to love. That's what they do. So... Let me sidetrack into something here real quick. As I was reading John and Mustafa Mann's conversation, I thought to myself, okay, so if I were making a movie out of this book, who would I cast?
Oh, man.
Oh, Hannah. Alan Rickman as Mustafa Mann.
Oh my gosh.
Don't you think?
Yeah.
Because the way they describe his voice is like in his deep voice. You know, you know how Alan Rickman has this very sepulchral voice.
Sepulchral. That's a good way to describe it.
Yeah. It's so good. He would be really good as Mustafa Mond. And I thought, okay, just off the top of your head, who would you cast as Bernard? That little weaselly, little... spiteful little
Steve Buscemi. Oh, that's just the first person I thought of who plays that kind of character.
Yeah, he plays
a lot.
That kind of character.
Yeah. Oh, well, but probably. Oh man,
I want to see if you come up with the same British actor as I did.
Oh, a British actor.
Yeah.
Martin Freeman.
Yeah. Whoa! That was a high five right over the microphone.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay, Martin Freeman. Oh, that's so good. You can tell that you and I are related.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So. The director of Hatchery.
He basically did play that kind of character in Fargo.
Exactly.
That suppressed little Minnesotan guy with his domineering wife who just ended up snapping and clobbering her with a hammer. Yeah.
Yes. Martin Freeman. I'm so, Hannah, just can't tell you how my little heart is going pitter-pat that you chose the same actor to play Bernard as I did.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, he'd be good at that one, too.
The director of Hatcheries.
I don't know as much about him. Like, I don't have a as good a idea of what kind of character he is.
John Cleese.
He's the one who gave the tour at the beginning, right?
Yes. Oh, gosh. He's the tour of the factory, you know?
Like, going along. Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah. Oh, the test tubes. Run their bottles.
Yes, yes. Look,
just all right. Spend all our days bottling and bottling and bottling.
Okay. Helmholtz Watson, the true poet.
Oh, goodness. Oh. I can't think of anything for this one either.
Benedict Cumberbatch.
Oh, my gosh. I was wondering. I was like, yeah, I can see that.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Now that I've said that, can you think of someone else?
It
might just be because, you know, I had Martin Freeman that I thought of, and I've got, you know, Holmes and Watson in my brain.
Yeah. Oh, goodness. I can't think of anybody.
Okay. Henry Foster, the little guy who, the director of hatcheries kind of, you know, helps him deliver the tour at the beginning of the book. And he's the person who is in the locker room talking with one of his friends about Lenina and like, oh, really? You should have her. She's jolly nice. She's so pneumatic.
Yeah. Oh, gosh.
Pneumatic means, by the way, nicely and pleasantly plump.
Oh, okay. See, I'm having trouble with this one. Because a lot of these guys, a lot of these characters, I can't tell the difference between them. Because they all act the same, mostly.
That's the idea. That's the idea in the Brave New World. They're all the same.
Oh, I see.
In fact, many of the people, because they have this process called bakinoskopization, that makes the egg, the fertilized egg, split into like 96, so you get 96 identical twins from one thing.
Yeah.
And they're all put in the same cast, and they all go do the same job.
Who would you cast as Henry Foster?
Daniel Radcliffe. Can you see him?
Yeah!
I say, Lenina is so jolly pneumatic. She's very nice.
Wow. Pneumatic.
Yeah. All right, now. Okay, now this, you should be able to come up with somebody for John. Blonde, sort of hunk.
Chris Hemsworth?
Yes!
Yeah, before he beefed up for Thor.
Yes, yes,
yeah.
Chris Hemsworth, exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we got two of them the same.
I know, yeah.
That's so great, yeah. But, yeah, I mean, if you read this book, casting it like that, I mean,
that's kind of
so, it's even funnier.
Oh, man.
It's even funnier.
Well, he would be American also.
Yes, because he can do an American accent.
No, oh, yes, he
can.
Chris Hemsworth can,
American accent?
Yeah. I would imagine John having, like, physique of Chris Hemsworth when he played the dad in Star Trek from the beginning with the hair of Thor.
Correct.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay, now, I had a little trouble thinking of anyone to be cast into female roles, though.
Yeah.
So, Lenina and Fanny, and then who else? Linda. Yeah, Linda is, she's in bad shape by the time we encounter her, because she's grown old.
Yeah.
Because without any of the benefits of the medical interventions to keep you young and healthy.
Kathy Bates could do it.
Oh, yeah, Kathy Bates. Sure, sure. Or Miriam Margoyles or something like that.
Yeah.
All right, and then Lenina, who's just, you know, beautiful young redhead, I think.
I think she's
described as a redhead, if I'm not mistaken.
Beautiful young redhead. I'm trying to think, because actresses all mostly look the same to me. Gosh.
They're all from the same Bakunovsky group.
Yeah, yeah.
Alpha
with
Plus.
With the different colored hair. Yeah, it's it's like that Onion video where they say that they've been just genetically engineering their Disney characters now.
Yeah, they're Disney actors? Yeah,
they're Disney actors.
Right, right.
Well, just one of the most beautiful British actors that I can think of is Carey Mulligan.
I mean, if anyone could grant some layering to a Brave New World character, it would be her, don't you think?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's who I would choose, because
But anyway, I really enjoy the fact that we had the same two cast members on our cast list of this book.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really hilarious. So let's segue into
Well, as usual, our time is up and we're not done talking. Tune in next time when we continue to talk about
insert episode topic here.
And now, the credits. The Splanknix podcast is produced by Claire T. Walker and Hannah Kubiak. You can contact us by emailing splanknixpodcast@gmail.com. We welcome episode topic suggestions, personal anecdotes, and corrections for those rare occasions when we don't know what we're talking about. Visit splanknext.com for show notes and transcripts of all our episodes, and follow us on Instagram at splanknext_podcast. Claire T. Walker is an independent author with two self-published books, The Keys of Death and Startling Figures. Learn more about Claire and her books at clairetwalker.com.